and welcome to Prehistory, the Archaeology of the Ancient Near East. My name is Jane, and today I want to talk to you about the Epipaleolithic. Over the last couple of weeks, we have looked at the Upper Paleolithic, when we humans came back into the Near East as modern humans, triumphed in the great evolutionary arms race over the Neanderthals, invented a bunch of new kit, which improved our ability to get food, as well as our fashion sense, and began to move a few fancy goods beyond the distance that we think a single community could have covered. This week, we're looking at the Epipaleolithic, the period which saw revolutionary changes in the way that we used food, moved around, modified our living spaces, dealt with monumental changes such as the death of a loved one, and managed our landscapes. Well, okay, maybe not so much a revolutionary period. The Epipaleolithic is actually a pretty tricky time period to think about in our prehistory, as it is mostly defined in relation to what happens next. Not to give the game away, but after the Epipaleolithic comes the Neolithic, when we humans stop having to go wandering around the landscape, hunting and gathering our food, and instead start to farm it ourselves closer to home. We are pretty much all farmers these days. At least in the sense that most of us don't get our food from hunting and gathering, and instead what we eat ultimately comes from one or many farmers. So it's not really a surprise that at some point we move from hunter-gatherers to farmers. But I do hate to spoil the plot for this story of our prehistory. Sorry about that, but in order to understand the Epipaleolithic and how we have looked at it, you do kind of need to be told that farming is what comes next. That's because the reason for splitting off the Epipaleolithic in terms of how we order the past in archaeology is pretty much because it's the time period that comes before farming. And so what happened here must have been pretty important for setting us humans up to decide to start growing our own food rather than just letting it do its own thing and then collecting some of it at the end. The difficulty with this is that the Epipaleolithic, as it's defined in the Near East, lasts from about 23 to 20,000 years ago to about 11,500 years ago, meaning that it runs from the last stage of the Pleistocene, what we call the last glacial maximum, and through the first part of the Holocene, the more modern interglacial period that we're living in now, up until the beginning of the Neolithic. In terms of explaining why this is difficult, I actually first need to tell you why the Epipaleolithic starts when it does. The Epipaleolithic was first identified from excavations in the Near East about 100 years ago. After a lot more work to understand what was happening and how human societies were changing in the run-up to farming, it was given its best definition after a detailed analysis of all of the known sites, which was done about 50 years ago. The Epipaleolithic is separated from the Neolithic mostly on the fact that people are still hunter-gatherers, although that's not the only difference, but we'll get to that later. The Epipaleolithic is separated from the Upper Paleolithic because of a stone tool industry dominated by microliths, in particular by bladelets or microbladelets, or basically very tiny blades, as well as an expansion of what people were eating, especially in the greater use of plant foods. The Epipaleolithic is also identified by the common finds of shell beads, as well as other beads, and the burial of people with grave goods. Okay, so if you've been listening to the episodes from the last few weeks, you might be a little confused now. This is one of the issues. Everything that I just listed as a hallmark of the Epipaleolithic is something that we've already seen in the archaeology of the Near East from the Upper Paleolithic, if not from as early as the Middle Paleolithic. This is a big part of the difficulty. These significant changes that identify the Epipaleolithic were used as part of its definition, and at the time, these were pretty much the first time that we were seeing these things in the archaeological record. After many more decades of work, we know that these were not necessarily firsts. So why do we still have an Epipaleolithic? Well, to begin with, we don't just have one Epipaleolithic. We have the classic trilogy of the early, middle, and late Epipaleolithic, although in some areas we have only two stages, and in some areas we really have more like four stages, with the late Epipaleolithic being divided in half, sometimes referred to as the final Epipaleolithic and sometimes named based on the technological or cultural group identified with it, the Natufian. There are differences in these stages, And we do see changes in the way that people were living during the Epipaleolithic, which means that we still keep it as a different period. The difficulty isn't so much with the late Epipaleolithic, where we are in a time of big changes to the climate of the Near East, as well as the rest of the world, as we come out of the Pleistocene. Where things get a bit awkward for archaeologists is in the beginning of the Epipaleolithic, and trying to explain why the early Epipaleolithic is different from the later stages of the Upper Paleolithic. A lot of this change from one period to the next really is based on the timing of the start of the last glacial maximum. And the big changes that we saw as indicating these changes to societies, things like the microliths, the jewelry, and the plant foods, are all things that we have more recently started finding in the Upper Paleolithic as well. This is why, over the last decade or two, Near Eastern archaeologists have been having a bit of a think on what to do about the earlier part of the Epipaleolithic. There have been some suggestions that this first part, the one that comes during the last glacial maximum, should be put back into the Upper Paleolithic, and we should think of the Epipaleolithic as being a lot shorter, just a couple of thousand years. The difficulty here is that even the earlier part of the Epipaleolithic isn't quite the same as the Upper Paleolithic. At the moment, we are still having a little bit of low-grade bickering rather than a full-blown not talking to one another at conferences argument like we used to have about the Neanderthals. Mostly, people are happy to keep the Epipaleolithic as it is, and just to point out that we need to pay more attention to the early and the middle Epipaleolithic when we're doing our research, and not just to focus on what happens at the end. This is another issue, too. Mostly, archaeologists have liked to look at the beginnings of things. The oldest evidence of people in the Near East, the beginning of modern human settlement at the initial part of the Upper Paleolithic, and so on. In the Epipaleolithic, it has been the end that has generally gotten a lot more attention, as it is both the end of the Epipaleolithic, as well as the very end of hunter-gatherers in the Near East, and thus also, in a way, the prologue or very beginning of the origins of farming. It is also a pretty cool period, but we really shouldn't be playing favorites. Then again, we do have to convince someone to give us a research grant every time we want to go and look at a site. So the very exciting end of hunter-gatherers and trying to understand why we decided to make the jump into the unknown with farming is a slightly easier sell than wanting to look at a middle Epipaleolithic site in order to understand the gradual process of development that societies went through in order to get to that exciting hunter-gatherer finale. On the upside, we have not completely neglected the earlier part of the Epipaleolithic. It might not get quite as much attention as its younger sibling, but it hasn't been completely neglected either. One of the hallmarks of the Epipaleolithic when it was first identified was the presence of microliths. In particular, little bladelets. In the Paleolithic, blades, bladelets, and flakes generally varied in terms of which ones you find more of on a given site, both when we look at sites from different parts of the Near East, as well as through time. While the proportion of microlithics that we find changes over the Upper Paleolithic, it is not necessarily always going up through time, as far as we can tell based on what we know now. By the time that we get to the early Epipaleolithic, and going on through the Epipaleolithic, bladelets are the most common tool type that we tend to find on sites. These don't just seem to have been the little microlithic pieces that were used for making composite points, like we've discussed before, as we have more specific tools which have been made out of these little bladelets. It's not really clear exactly why we get this greater trend towards making bladelets and making tools on bladelets. It isn't necessarily that people had more difficulty getting good stone for making tools and were therefore trying to conserve material, because we see this way of making tools even at sites which are right next to good sources of stone. It might be a difference in the way that a lot of these tools were used, but we don't necessarily have any good evidence for a major change like this. For now, we can just think of this greater interest in making bladelets as a bit of a fashion change in toolmaking that comes along probably towards the end of the Upper Paleolithic and is pretty common across the Near East by the earlier part of the Epipaleolithic. So we do see changes in the tools, but it's not some sort of dramatic or sudden change. We also get a bit of a fashion in the shape of these bladelets through time. This has been best studied in the Levant and in a couple of sites from Anatolia where we have good sequences. In the Levant, the early Epipaleolithic is associated with what's called the Keberin, named after Kebara Cave. In the early Keberin part of the Epipaleolithic, we have a lot of thin bladelets without much emphasis being put into consistency in their shape. By about 17,500 years ago, we get either a change in the way that these tools were being used or in the fashion for their appearance, and they start to be made in more geometric shapes, such as triangles, rectangles, and C-shaped or lunate pieces, and this change distinguishes the Middle Epipaleolithic or the geometric Keberin. This change in shape over time isn't necessarily seen in other parts of the Near East, such as in the Zagros Mountains, where you get a range of shapes all through the Epipaleolithic, with long and skinny bladelets being generally more common and only a smaller increase through time in the presence of the other shapes. In the Zagros, the Epipaleolithic is identified with the Zarzian complex. Like the Keberin, it's named after the first place where it was identified, in this case Zarzi Cave in what's now Iraq. The Zarzian doesn't have the classic trilogy that we think of for the Epipaleolithic, and instead is really just divided into early and late Zarzian, with the late being equivalent to the rest of the late Epipaleolithic everywhere else in the Near East, where we have the end of the Pleistocene and the beginning of the Holocene. We talked last week about seashells and other shell beads turning up in the Upper Paleolithic. These shell beads also turn up in the Near East in the Epipaleolithic, and are actually pretty common across the Near East in the Levant as well as in areas a lot farther from the sea, such as in the Zagros Mountains. Some of these beads are made out of the shells of freshwater mollusks or something like land snails, but quite a few of them are made out of Mediterranean shells, even in areas really far from the sea. This ties into something else that we talked about last week, in the movement of things like seashells over long distances. While this is seen in the Upper Paleolithic, things like seashells traveling over 100 kilometers, or about 60 miles, isn't exactly common. In the Epipaleolithic, even in the early Epipaleolithic, it's no longer all that unusual to find seashells about 100 kilometers or more from their original seas. These aren't just the whole shell that's been pierced, and it's a lot more common than before to find shells that have been cut and shaped into what we think of as more of a bead shape. In the early Epipaleolithic, we see these shell beads moving over pretty long distances. But for a lot of areas in the Near East, in particular for the ones closer to the coast, we're really only seeing the shells moving. In the more inland parts of the Near East, we still see the shells moving around, but we also see obsidian moving long distances too. We have obsidian from sources in Anatolia and the Caucasus, which turns up at earlier Epipaleolithic sites in the Zagros Mountains and in highland Iran, about 200 to 300 kilometers, or about 125 to 200 miles away from where they were originally picked up. Now, these sites in the more mountainous inland parts of the Near East are a lot closer to the old volcanoes, which is where you get the obsidian, than the sites from around the Mediterranean coast. That being said, by the Middle Epipaleolithic, or the geometric Keberin in the Levant, by about 17,500 years ago, we do start to find obsidian at sites of the Levant, which is coming from sources in Anatolia and the Caucasus. And on these sites, the obsidian is coming from more than 500 kilometers, or more than 300 miles. And sometimes it's coming from nearly 1,000 kilometers, or about 600 miles away. This greater movement of goods, like shells and obsidian, suggests that the interaction between communities and the sharing of objects that we saw in the Upper Paleolithic is not only still happening in the Epipaleolithic, but that it's intensified. We still don't see huge quantities of things traveling hundreds of kilometers around the landscape into each and every site, but we do see a lot more things moving, and moving longer distances. This suggests that people living in the Near East were tied into pretty big social networks that stretched over large areas of the whole Near East, even if individual communities in, say, southern Jordan may not have been in direct contact with communities in Anatolia. One of the big things that was used to define the Epipaleolithic is that it is the time right before we stopped hunting and gathering and started to grow our own food. So, of course, looking at what people were hunting and gathering has been a big part of the research into the Epipaleolithic in the Near East. One of the big things that was used to define the Epipaleolithic is that it is the time right before we stopped hunting and gathering and started to grow our own food. So, of course, looking at what people were hunting and gathering has been a big part of the research into the Epipaleolithic in the Near East. This brings me to sickles. A sickle is basically a knife that you use to cut plants, like grasses, including grains. In the Stone Ages, these were, of course, made of stone. You may remember a few weeks ago when we were looking at the Middle Paleolithic and I talked about phytoliths, the little silica bits that form between the cells of plants and help to make them more rigid so that they can hold themselves upright. Well, the phytoliths inside plants do something interesting to sickles. When you're using the same stone blade over and over to cut through something like the stems of wild grasses, such as wild barley, then the phytoliths inside of the plants repeatedly rub up against the surface of the sickle blades as it cuts through them. This rubbing polishes the surface of the sickle, giving it what we have inventively called sickle gloss. This is not a subtle gloss either. It often looks like the whole side of the blade has been varnished. The fact that this is not subtle is one of the things that led to them being noticed during excavations, beginning even a long time ago. One of the big things that defined the Epipaleolithic was the common presence of these sickles, as well as the common presence of grinding stones on Epipaleolithic sites. This meant that one of the things that was seen as a big change in the Epipaleolithic was the widespread use of plant resources by Epipaleolithic hunters and gatherers. Of course, the problem here is that people were looking at the stone tools used to collect and process plants and not actually looking at the remains of the plants themselves. In more recent decades, we have started to routinely wash our dirt on excavations, using flotation so that we can actually find the plant remains which have been preserved. This means that we're no longer limited to looking only at the tools that were used to collect and process plants, and it also means that we know that people have been eating plants in the Near East since all the way back in the Lower Paleolithic. It also means that we know that people were gathering and eating a good range of plants throughout the Upper Paleolithic. So, widespread use of plants is another one of the hallmarks of the Epipaleolithic that actually isn't something new to the Epipaleolithic, and was instead something that was happening for a while before we get to this period. Except that this isn't strictly true either. Yes, we were collecting and eating plants pretty commonly in the Upper Paleolithic, but there does seem to have been a change in emphasis. In particular, a change in the level of the work that we put into processing plants. And that suggests that plant foods may have been more important to people's diets in the Epipaleolithic than they were before. We get grinding stones turning up on Upper Paleolithic sites in the Near East. These aren't particularly common, but we do have a few examples. By the Epipaleolithic, the idea of grinding stones seems to have gotten around, because we now find them pretty regularly. We also don't just find the nice flat stones which were rubbed together to break down the plants, but towards the end of the early Epipaleolithic, and certainly by the middle Epipaleolithic, we start to see cup mortars, like a modern mortar and pestle. These take a lot more time to make than just using two flat rocks, so it looks like the effort that people put into processing plants has not only increased between the Upper Paleolithic and the Early Epipaleolithic, but has also increased again when we go through the Early Epipaleolithic and into the Middle Epipaleolithic. We also start to see something interesting in the mortars themselves. A lot of these grinding stones that we find, at least in the Levant, are made out of basalt, which is extremely hard stone, so it works really well for this. First, basalt is really hard to carve. So making a mortar and pestle out of this is a lot more effort than it would be even just to make it out of another kind of stone. You also do find basalt in the Levant, but you don't find it everywhere. When geologists have looked at these basalt mortars, they're also not always from the type of basalt which is the closest one to the site. So it looks like these might have been moving around the landscape too. Basalt is a lot harder to identify to its source than obsidian is. So we don't know exactly how far these things were tending to move around, but the idea that they were moving, along with the shells and the obsidian, is pretty interesting. This suggests that there are two things happening at once here in the early and the middle Epipaleolithic. First, people are probably putting a lot more effort into getting and processing plant foods. This suggests that they were either experimenting with new tastes and new cooking techniques, or that they were trying to get more food out of their landscape. That could suggest that they were either not moving around quite as much, and were thus stripping the area of the easiest things to eat before they move somewhere else, or it means that communities were a bit bigger, or maybe there were more communities moving around in the same area, and hence you needed to get more food out of the landscape all the time. At this point, the animals that were being hunted haven't changed all that much from the Upper Paleolithic. We're still looking at people mostly hunting gazelle, deer, and wild goats and sheep, with the preferred animal that was hunted changing depending on where in the Near East you're looking. We still mostly are seeing the individual selection of prime-aged animals, just like we saw in the Upper Paleolithic. So while we really shouldn't be thinking about the people living in the Near East in this first half of the Epipaleolithic as completely stripping the landscape bare and trying to rub every calorie out of every potential bit of food, they do seem to have taken a greater interest in collecting and processing the plant foods at each stop where they moved around the landscape. Next time, we'll have a look at the later stages of the Epipaleolithic, and see how much we do seem to have been moving around compared with the earlier stages of the Epipaleolithic. Did we really just decide to stop wandering around and to settle down in a nice valley? What did this mean for our ability to find food? Did anyone else take advantage and move in to mooch off of our food? I say next time because it's almost the end of the year, and I have only one more episode after this before we move from the Epipaleolithic into the big bad world of domestication, farming, and interaction spheres in the Neolithic. I want to keep the Neolithic together, and I want to wait to start us on a new way of getting our food when we start the new year. So I'm going to wait an extra week before we look at the changes of the later Epipaleolithic, and then after that, there'll be another week off before we start the Neolithic in the new year. Thank you for listening to the Prehistory Podcast. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at prehistorypodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to see some examples of the things that I've talked about today, then you can find these on the website at prehistorypodcast.com. And come back in 2 weeks when we settle down into the post-ice age warming landscape of the later Epipaleolithic.